this podcast up to date is hungry for Middle Eastern and Mediterranean food. When you want a euro, where in the KC Metro do you eat? Do you know the best place to get kofta? Tell us where to go and what to order. Text us at 816-601-4777. 816-601-4777. Standard texting rates apply.
From KCUR, this is Up to Date with Steve Kraske. I'm producer Hallie Jackson. Storytelling is central to human nature, but over time, histories of many people in our region have been suppressed or marginalized. And for the last 3 years, researchers in Kansas and the Kansas City area have been working to recover many of these histories. It's all a part of a digital storytelling project based at the University of Kansas called Stories for All. And the projects will be featured at an upcoming festival in downtown Lawrence. Today, we'll talk about the festival and hear from some of the people whose work and research will be on display. To start out, Steve spoke with Giselle Anatol. She's the director of the Hall Center for the Humanities at KU and is the principal investigator for the Stories for All project. And before we go any further, I should note, the festival is a sponsor of KCUR.
So you're the director of the Hall Center for the Humanities at KU, which has championed this Stories for All project. How did the whole thing get started?
The former director of the Hall Center was one of the key movers and shakers of the project. Through the Mellon Foundation, we're funded by the Mellon Foundation, this project was developed. And so there are over 40 community partners involved, which is an amazing way for us to kind of funnel some of the funds that we have received into these different partner organizations so that they can do the projects that they really want to do.
Explain that to me. What kinds of things are they doing?
Oh, all kinds of things. There's a project, this Pika Bottoms project, that is recovering the history from this displaced community of Mexican and Mexican American people in Topeka. There's a project for little-known composers associated with the American jazz scene and the Kansas City jazz scene, the Jazz Museum. Nasir will talk about the project. There are projects on indigenous cultures. There's the Toni Morrison Bench by the Road project that has been a long-standing, years-long project to recognize really important cultural sites for African Americans and people of the African diaspora around the world.
So there's a need to recover a lot of stories here, is what you're saying.
Yes, yes. All of these different groups, whether they are thinking about, they're thinking very, very locally in terms of community stories, and the stories that have not been valued, but groups that have not had the resources to preserve the stories, whether that's in a traditional sense. I think years ago that would have been in physical archives. Mm-hmm. What's really interesting, I think, about the Digital Storytelling Project is that now these groups are getting training and funds to think about storing these projects digitally so that people not just who come to a physical space can access the materials and the stories, but people anywhere who have access to Wi-Fi or, you know, they can get a hold of these stories. And
that's a new way for us to think about sort of housing stories like this. We used to keep them in file cabinets and that kind of thing. And
yes,
you're describing something very different to me now.
Yes, yes. So I think that's been a big learning curve for lots of people. And so the IDRH at KU, the Institute for Digital Research in the Humanities, was also involved in kind of doing a few workshops. There were people, so thinking about different ways or different platforms that people might use to store the information, whether a group just needed a website so that people could find them and find more information about them and their organization and what they do, or find these kind of where can you hold lots of data.
And so the goal here is what, Giselle?
Well, I think first it's access, so that more people can access the technology, have the funds to kind of get these stories out there, but then people from the wider community can access the stories in an easier way. But it's also, I think there's a huge networking component, which is really exciting to me, so that a lot of the community partners involved, when they come together and learn the technologies, or when they come together to have a session on the ethics of collecting oral histories and how do you preserve people's privacy or things like that, they're also learning together and asking each other questions like, how did you do this? Or could you share where you found the information for this? Or that's a really interesting set of stories. I really want to hear more about your community.
Yeah. And when you talk about these stories, what are some of the stories that stand out to you? What kinds of ideas are being expressed that you think are worth hanging on to?
Oh, wow. All of them.
Yeah, and right.
In my family, I'm the storyteller. So I have long been a storyteller. And I think my my partner will often say, okay, I want the short version. And I'm like, no, you have to hear the long version. You need all of the details. But people are so varied and so so interesting. And I think increasingly in our culture where, you know, there are the algorithms where we only hear one type of story when we go on to social media or, you know, we do a search, a digital search. This is a really interesting project. And I think the festival is really exciting for bringing all of these different populations, stories, individuals, histories, cultures to kind of together in one.
What's going to happen at this festival?
What
can people expect?
Sure. So the first night we will have a reception and we will have four folks on the keynote panel who are coming to talk about their own kind of nationally, internationally recognized work in digital storytelling. The list of folks is on the website. So there's one on feminist restaurants and kitchens, one on the woman who's coming to speak has done her work in that area. Another speaking about his work on gay and lesbian history through t-shirts, right? So I think, again, different ways of thinking about history and different ways of thinking about how we can read and analyze and learn about other people, other communities through a variety of objects and a variety of stories.
And if people come over to Lawrence to take part in the festival, how do they do that?
It's free. They can register. They can go on. Please do go onto the website, the Stories for All Stories for All Festival website, and I can give you that so that you can post it for your listeners. So Thursday night is that, and then on Friday we'll have panels. So different groups will be talking about their projects. There'll be a few projects on display, and then there will be a short kind of a little mini film festival, where those who have captured their stories via film and visual media will be showing clips. And then Saturday, there will be more presentations of the different projects, and we'll wrap up with
that. So lots of ways to connect here.
Yes, definitely. You can come for a little bit. You can come for all of it. But we're really excited to share these stories.
When we come back, we'll hear from two people who are a part of the Stories for All project. Stick with us.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back. We're talking about the Stories for All project, a digital storytelling endeavor that's culminating in a festival in downtown Lawrence later this week. We'll hear more from Steve's conversation about the Stories for All festival in just a bit, but first, I had the chance to talk with Rachel Schwaller. She's a multi-term lecturer in the departments of history and religious studies at KU, and is the researcher behind a project with Stories for All called Unsettled Lawrence. So, Rachel, you're working on a project through Stories for All called Unsettled Lawrence. And I was hoping we could start by having you talk a little bit about, like, what you're trying to do with this work.
So my project looks at encamped houseless populations across time in Lawrence, and it's two-pronged. On the one hand, I'm looking back in the historical archives, looking for hidden references to encampment in Lawrence, and there's quite a lot. And then on the other hand, I've spent almost a year and a half now doing an ethnography of current encamped populations in Lawrence and recording oral histories from them. And what I'm doing, though, I just want to point out, is not possible without the people outside who let me into their lives. And I am so grateful, and I really want to highlight that.
You mentioned that the first part of the project is archival. You said that there's like a lot of history in Lawrence. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what kinds of history you've come across so far.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that got me started on the project was in teaching people a history of the peoples of Kansas. And in that class, of course, we talk a lot about Kansas history, Lawrence, and John Brown. And within that, one of the things that occurred to me, and we talked about with my students and stuff, was that, for example, the women after Quantrill's raid, they were technically houseless. Their homes had been burnt. And what they were doing is they were staying either in one of the only remaining hotels in Kansas, or excuse me, in Lawrence, or they were staying on friends' couches. They were couch surfing, which is what we call that today. They were precariously housed. So part of my question was, okay, why don't we consider these women, why don't we label them houseless? Or white settlers who are coming into Kansas and spending months on the road in wagons, why do we not call them houseless? They have this intention of settlement, whereas other people we do devalue and call houseless. And so that was part of my question. So I want to be able to find references in the archives that are talking about people who are categorized as houseless, and because of that, they are devalued, but also hidden mentions of houselessness, things that we don't term or categorize as houseless, so that we can begin to, in fact, normalize the movement of people.
Moving to the other part of this project, you've spent a lot of time, you said, with unhoused folks in Lawrence as sort of an ethnographic study. Tell me more about that part of all of this. What kind of work are you doing there?
Yeah, an ethnographer basically is a method that says the best way to learn about someone is to listen and to be with them. So I started out by, you know, serving food and just being present, and then starting to go out to what was called Camp New Beginnings. People there did not call it that. They called it Tent City, and it's now no longer there because it was bulldozed. So I started going to Tent City and just kind of asking, may I sit by the fire with you? And I've never been told no. They always say yes, and then ask me questions about why I'm there. And when I tell them I'm there to write a history of Lawrence that focuses on camping, they have been so excited about that. And so they begin to start telling stories almost immediately. And that level of trust, I don't take lightly, and I certainly don't take for granted. So I started to just kind of be there. And then I would listen or talk with them, or they would talk with me about their lived experience every day. So I've done things like helping to set up campsites with people. I have been there when there's been bulldozing that has happened and experienced what that feels like and the trauma of that. I've been there on times where everybody's laughing. I've been there on times where everyone's crying. And the idea is simply to exist with people as people.
Yeah. What kinds of things did you come into this experience like wanting to document about the experience that your storytellers have had?
Yeah. I probably did come in with ideas because we're always biased in that way. But my storytellers are the ones that really determined where the project was going. So the one thing that I took very quickly, and I was corrected on very quickly, is saying, we're not camping, we're living. a lot of times when you say the word camping or encampment, it is again a devaluing or maybe something someone's just doing for fun. They are very clear that this is a way of living. I want to be clear, most people out there would never say it's the best way of living, but it is a way of surviving, right? So in seeking to understand that, I've wanted to ask stories about it. What does it mean to survive outside in the winter or in the massive heat of the summer or in Kansas winds, right? If you've never tried to set up a tent in the middle of Kansas winds, then it's a really hard thing to understand. One of the other things that they pointed me towards was how much skill it takes to live outside and to live outside and survive.
And so when we talk about like skill, is it just, you know, the skills about like setting up things that will stay through hard winds? Yeah. Or is it something else that we're talking about here?
It is that, and it's also more. So, and I think that this gets to kind of the point of the project, how people settle, how do we change the landscape? How do we live in that landscape? What ways are valued versus what ways are devalued? So for example, people who are outside in some of these encampments have made showers outside. They've made pits. The pits are a really good example because people see that and they think, well, that's very frustrating. Now there's this massive pit. Earth has been moved. It changes everything. But actually the pits are incredibly valuable because in the winter, they are excellent sources of heat because you can make it a fire pit and you can put rocks in it and heat the rocks. In the summer, you can actually fill the pit with water and it becomes a cool place to sit. These are structures that are being made here. They are not just tents. And I think that if our community had a better understanding of the skill it takes to do that and also of the generational knowledge that gets passed down, they may have a better grasp of what it actually looks like.
Yeah. Well, I think this maybe segues pretty nicely into the next thing that I wanted to ask you about, which is that you have an upcoming exhibit of sorts at the Stories for All Festival next week. Tell us about what you're going to have going on that people can see and experience about what you've done with this project so far.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. The exhibit is called Living, Not Camping, again, based on what my storytellers have told me. And it's going to set up a campsite inside, so to be inside the Carnegie Building. And the idea is to try and let people know what goes into making a camp, which includes all of its tarps, how things are, you know, how things look. In particular, this will be a summer camp. And so in showing the multiple tarps, the things that might look unkempt or unclean, that there are reasons why they look like that and they are there in that way. And then people will be able to go into the tent. They'll hear, you know, the sound of trains, which is constant at all of the campsites. It is incredibly loud. So hearing the sound of trains, but then they will also see art from people at all of the different camps. And so in seeing that artwork, again, part of the question that I want to, and that we hope people will kind of take away from this is, how is this a form of settlement? How is this a form of living? And I just want to be very clear again, I am not advocating in any way for camping and for being outside, but that doesn't mean we have to actively devalue and destroy what people have created currently.
Yeah. When you talk to, you know, your storytellers and your artists who have helped you put all of this together, like what do they think about, you know, putting their work out there in this way for kind of this, in this experience, like the public to see and appreciate?
They were very excited to do it. Everyone that I have spoken to knows that they are actively excluded from the Lawrence community, but they don't. What I found interesting is they don't connect that to addiction or criminality or those sorts of things. They connect it to the way that they live. And this is also what I'm trying to show in the historical record, that this is historically the case as well, that people who are not quote unquote settling in the way that society has deemed appropriate cannot enter that society.
Yeah.
The idea that someone from KU you know, reached out to them and wanted their artwork and their thoughts in the art show. For some of them, it was unbelievable. These are our community members. And simply because they are in a tent doesn't mean that they shouldn't be able to engage with our community. And I'm hoping that that's what this project does, that, you know, it's not my message or an academic message or something like that that comes across, but instead the sincere desire for people to be seen as people and as part of this community, no matter how they're living.
Rachel, thank you so much for taking some time to speak with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Let's go back to Steve's conversation with Giselle Anatol. They're joined also by Nazir Anthony Montalvo. They're the founder of BQKC, an archive of Black queer history in Kansas City. Let's listen.
Your project is an archive of the Black queer community in Kansas City. What first got you interested in collecting and then displaying this history?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm a Kansas City transplant. I moved here in 2021, and I'm originally from the East Coast. I went to school in the tri-state area, so I was always surrounded and connected to Black queer community.
Tri-state area is?
New York, New Jersey. And so when
we don't know about tri-state areas out here in the heart.
Yeah.
We're a long way from your home.
Yeah. I got to let the people know in the Midwest. Yeah. Right? So when I came to the Midwest, one of my first goals was getting plugged into the Black queer community here. And I think similar to what Giselle was saying, I use a lot of social media and digital media to try to find this. And there was virtually nothing. All I could find was like one Reddit post asking my same question.
Really?
Where is Black queer community in Kansas City?
So you decided to do something about it.
Yes.
What did you do?
So I went on this kind of like a long research project where I was working with the Kansas City Defender, another news outlet here in Kansas City. And sort of my project for them became a meld between my own interests and investigation for the Defender into what is the prevalence at all of Black queer Kansas Cityans in the historical record. And so I began working with the Gay and Lesbian Archives. I was calling around to different libraries and archives in Kansas City to try and find any ephemera, photos, documents on Black queer Kansas City history. And really the only organization that had anything was the Gay and Lesbian Archives.
Wow.
But it was a small cart of material. And all that was there on the cart were like these three distinct topics. They were like the first kind of well-documented Black drag queens of Kansas City, Edie Gregory and Ray Rondell. There was some material on this organization called Men of All Colors Together, which was a group of gay men who were fighting racism in the queer community in Kansas City. And then finally, there was material on this gay and lesbian variety show called Out There that aired from 1993 to 1994 on public access cable in Kansas City. And so for the entirety of 2022, it was me sort of liberating these materials from the archive, wherein the Gay and Lesbian Archives didn't have plans to digitize these materials. And I wanted to build a digital footprint and kind of dig deeper into these histories and share them in the digital realm so that people who had my same questions when I was coming to Kansas City, or even Kansas Cityans now who may not know anything about these Black queer histories, can now Google Black queer Kansas City and have answers.
And you're looking at this cart and surely you're thinking there's a lot more history that has taken place in this town than what's represented in the boxes you were looking at.
Yeah, 100%. So that's kind of where my transition came in at the end of 2022. Because of the digital humanities and having like these digital scans of these materials now populating a digital footprint, I now had, I guess, the power to reproduce these materials where you can't really do that with like a physical material. So I think that is like a plus of being able to have digital reproductions of things. So
this program, did it help fund you to do some of this work?
Yes, 100%. Yeah. So through Stories for All and their grant funding, I was able to do these kind of multi-location exhibits of the materials that I had in like coffee shops and bookstores. And the reason that I mentioned this is because through doing these in-person exhibits, I was able to share the history with a lot more people who weren't following the Defender or maybe didn't even have access to the internet. But as a result of doing those exhibits, I also got plugged in to the underground ballroom community in Kansas City. And that is how I began to like find a lot more of Black queer Kansas
City. See, the underground ballroom community?
Yes.
Tell me about that. I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, so kind of the underground ballroom community. How do I explain ball? So ball is just like Black queer tradition, like across various cities, wherein balls are sort of competitions, pageants, shows that Black queer community put on as a means to perform and perform to be real, quote unquote.
Okay. And
performing to be real means they'll have like certain categories on like the category will be like business. And so you dress as like this sexy, sensual business person trying to mimic what would it be like to be a Black queer person in this role where you can't be that, you know, necessarily in reality because of barriers.
And this is a fairly prevalent, broad-based community.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. So in Kansas City, this is something that's happening, you know, in New York and Florida. And so Kansas City has one of these like ballroom communities as well. And I want to stress, too, that it's called ballroom, but there's a lot more to it than just, you know, pageant shows. It's also about family, survivalhood, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, you've also focused on a place recently, a bar called Soakies.
Yes.
Tell me about that place.
Yeah. So after I got plugged into this community, one of the top things I was hearing was about Soakies. So interestingly enough, Soakies was a sandwich shop, an Italian sandwich shop in downtown Kansas City that opened around the 1960s, ran by the Italian mob, founded by Salvatore A. Rinaldo.
And this connects to the queer community how? I'm waiting for the connection here. The suspense is building. Yeah.
So in 1993-ish, Soakies became this pregame spot for Black queer people because it was next to another Black bar called Connections. And, you know, just by word of mouth, a lot of Black queer people started going there. One person goes there, they tell their friends, et cetera, et cetera. Salvatore A. Rinaldo was kind of having his business suffer at the time, and he was expressing this to some of the Black queer people that attended his bar. So they pitched, you know, since this is already a pregame spot, what if you just turn this into the spot?
And so he was open to that?
He was open to it. And so
The world turns in Kansas City, that's kind of an amazing story in itself. Yeah.
It was an amazing partnership, something I think relatively unheard of, especially from the early 90s. And so from 1993 to 2004, Soakies would be like an Italian sandwich shop during the day and a Black gay nightclub at night. And, you know,
and Giselle,
I mentioned
this is exactly the kind of story you're looking to get out of this project. Right? This is really amazing.
And this is fascinating because I've been to Soakies and it's really striking to me. Now, I also see this gap that, you know, you don't know about Soakies. And there, you know, so many of the people that I know in Kansas City from when I first got here, you know, there were several places that are no longer in existence. So Soakies and Tootsies and there were several, I think Weatherby's was the name of another one, but there were several women's bars that are no longer in existence because I think it again speaks to the ways that certain barriers have been knocked down. So today's queer youth don't feel like they need spaces where there are only queer people in that space. They feel very comfortable going into a host of different kinds of spaces. But then where does that leave people when they come to the city and they're looking for community? Like, how do I find my people?
Yeah, I think another important aspect of the project is that there is nothing online pertaining to Soakies or Tootsies or Weatherby's or like this host of Black gay bars or Black queer history.
Right.
But at the same time, stressing again the importance of capturing things in the digital. So I found out about Silkies, you know, through word of mouth, but people also had, you know, scrapbooks, photo books of like their photos that they took at Silkies, but a lot of it was damaged, yellowing, torn, held together by tape, water damage.
Right.
And so they were kind of on their last limb. And so by capturing the digital, it's not full preservation because, you know, I'm not keeping them in boxes in a temperature control back room.
But you got something here.
Yeah. It's like, it's, I've frozen it in time so that now it'll be able to be captured in the digital, hopefully forever.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Well, you're going to be speaking at the Stories for All Festival in the next few days. What are you going to be talking about?
Yes, so I believe on Friday there'll be a panel presentation breakout at around 10:30. The breakout room is specifically going to be on approaches to documenting voices digitally. And so the panel will be with my archive, BQKC, and the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. So it'll be a really interesting panel because we'll be getting to hear from this like very large institution about the ways they document oral and whatever else history is digitally.
Right.
And I'll be talking from more of a community-centered, non-extractive method of collecting Black queer history.
Well, that's a very fancy term you just applied to what you're doing. I think I sort of get it. Yeah.
And can I just jump in here for a second?
Please,
I think, you know, when you just mentioned the Nelson Atkins, I think, and digitizing, people might think about storytelling only in terms of oral stories, but I think one of the things that the festival is doing really well is thinking about different kinds of media for stories. So the way that art can tell a story, visual stories, or film is another storytelling media, right? And so we have all of these different, I think it helps people to think more expansively about the ways that they can capture their own stories. You know, scrapbooks, right? Like those are our stories and the stories of people's lives. And so we hope that people will also come and get inspired to think about their own stories and the ways that they can also share or contribute to other people.
Well, it's just interesting that Ness, you're talking about Silkies. This is a history that is relatively recent, but if I'm hearing you correctly, it's also, you're in danger of losing a lot of material that would represent what, you know, what that was back in the day, and already, even though it's only been a few decades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which is kind of amazing. It's recent history already disappearing.
Yeah, yeah. There is definitely a grave need not only to archive, but to continue storytelling. And so, yeah, I want my archive to operate in a lot of different ways. So not only do, yeah, I want to freeze this in a moment of time because it's on the brink of being destroyed and never regained again. But at the same time, now that I have these materials, I think it's now important to storytell with them.
So Nasir, where can people go to see the work you've been doing?
Yeah, so actually really excitingly, for the entire month of April, the archive launched earlier this year on March 1st with three inaugural collections from Black Queer Eldership, the Gary Carrington Collection, the Starla Carr Collection, and the Tisha Taylor Collection. So these collections are now spread out at different coffee shops and bookstores across Kansas City. Mm. Café Corazón, Black and Brown, PH Coffee, Waterbird Coffee, and Astringent Press. And so for the entire month of April, audiences in Kansas City and beyond will be able to go to these different coffee shops and bookstore and print press and view this archival material.
I'm just guessing you still have a lot of work to do. I imagine the deeper you get into this, the more you find that you need to do.
Yeah, 100%. Silkies was just the very surface of the stories there are to tell. There's so much on the Black Cape Pride in Kansas City. Giselle mentioned Tootsies and Weatherbees. And so, yeah, I'm really hoping to build the infrastructure and expand so that I can capture and tell these stories effectively.
That was Nasir Montalvo. They're the founder of BQKC, an archive of Black queer history in Kansas City that will be a part of the Stories for All Festival. We also heard this episode from Giselle Anatole, the director of the Hall Center for Humanities at KU, who's the principal investigator for the Stories for All project. We also heard from Rachel Schwaller, who's behind the Unsettled Lawrence project that we heard about. Up to Date is a production of KCUR, and this episode was produced by me, Hallie Jackson. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back with more Up to Date soon.
Hollywood writers are obsessed with the concept of an asteroid heading towards Earth and destroying civilization. But is this something we really should be worried about? I'm Kate the Chemist, and on my podcast, Seeking a Scientist, we meet the mastermind behind a real-life mission to divert the path of an asteroid. Subscribe to Seeking a Scientist, made possible by the Starris Institute.